then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be. In the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder, by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's May the 26th, 2011. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest.
There beside the singing river, that dark mass of men were seen, far above their shining weapons, on their own beloved green. Death to every foe and traitor, forward strike the marching tune, and hurrah, my voice for freedom, is the rising.
Nothing much by way of an Edgar Steele update this week. The so-called establishment media coverage has subsided, preparatory to sending the whole revolting case down the memory hole and burying Ed Steele alive. There are supposedly plans for an appeal of Steele's grotesque conviction, and Cindy Steele is doing a lot of interviews raising hell about the farce wherein her husband was not allowed to call witnesses in his defense. But mostly, these interviews she's doing are with quote-unquote our internet and other media, so she won't be reaching the white community itself, but only that small portion of it that's racially aware. In addition, there is the question of how much an appeal will cost and who will pay for it. One interesting Steele-related item did surface in the media this week. It seems that Edgar Steele's first court-appointed attorney, a guy named Roger Peven, or Peven, not sure how you pronounce that, is being eased out of his position as the lead federal public defender for his district due to being a drunk and an asshole. On May the 17th, there was an article in the Spokane Spokesman Review by Thomas Klaus to that effect. Apparently, Peven once took a leave of absence to spend 30 days in a rehab clinic to dry out, at government expense, of course, and he's now being sued by three of the attorneys on his own staff for basically being a jackass. Well, if that ain't the pot calling the kettle black. Now bear in mind that for almost 8 of the 9 months prior to Edgar Steele's trial, this Roger Peven guy was the bozo in charge of his defense. Beautiful. No wonder nothing got done for 8 months. Now this Spokesman Review article also reveals a couple of more interesting items of information. It seems that Roger Peven is being paid $155,000 per year in taxpayer money to do nothing, at least according to the lawsuit. And also, he's now the defense attorney for Kevin Harpham, the supposed maker of the bionic backpack in Spokane last January. I'm sure Harpham is just filled with confidence at the prospect of having as his defense attorney an aging clown who is a self-admitted alcoholic who's being sued by his own staff for paranoid and irrational behavior, and who appears to be on the verge of losing his job due to incompetence. And believe me, in the federal government, you gotta be really incompetent for that to happen. Great judicial system we've got in this country, huh? Got an email from Gretchen the Librarian regarding the draft version of the 5th Northwest Independence novel, Freedom's Sons. Now, I know most of you aren't on the proofing and review committee, and so you're not familiar with that one. Anyway, the draft is now up to 150,000 words, and the completed book will probably be longer than the brigade. I did publish the latest draft chapter on the Thought Crime blog last week. The one where the Americans launched their big invasion to reconquer the Northwest Republic 12 years after the Longview Treaty called Operation Strikeout, and this is the chapter she's referring to. Dear Harold, do you think the victories are too easy in this chapter? I loved reading it. Is it false hope? No communication except what Georgia needs for her text. My favorite song from No Remorse, by the way, is We Fly the Swastika. I enjoyed the show this week. Well, Maybe, yeah. The first day of the war seems a little facile, but part of the reason the Northwest victories were easy is I want to show our people that victory is, in fact, possible. To get them out of the habit of thinking in terms of nothing but endless defeat. A large part of the reason novel number 5 is being written is because I keep getting this whine about, oh no, Harold, white people could never set up our own country because Zog would just nuke us. We have to do something about this pervasive attitude of defeatism that runs through our whole little subculture like woodworm and dry rot. The purpose of the Northwest novels is to give white people a vision of possibility, to show us what the cover of the puzzle box looks like, so to speak, so that we can fit all the pieces together. It is not inevitable that we will always lose. It is not inevitable that this monster in Washington, D.C. will always triumph. But so long as we believe these things to be the case, then things really are hopeless. Okay, as you know, if you're a regular listener, for the past several weeks, we've had a young lady calling herself Axis Sally reading some of the segments on Radio Free Northwest. And her presence has given rise to the usual kind of deranged goat dancing on the internet, although now it seems to be pretty much restricted to Facebook. Anyway, the official version from the Gooboo crew is now that Axis Sally doesn't really exist, and she's actually me, using something called a voice modulator, whatever that is. Now, I know that there are many of you who think that I shouldn't be responding to this nonsense, and I should just ignore it, and it'll go away. But the problem is, that's not the way it works in real life. In real life, if you let something like this slide, then it doesn't just go away. It creeps into the narrative, as the liberals would say, and years later you will find the purest crap being presented as fact and taken as gospel truth by people who basically just don't know any better. Anyway, so, she's here in my, well, what passes for my studio right now, and let's get the facts straight from the horse's mouth. Sally, are you a voice modulator?
No, I am a real female human woman.
You're not a cyborg. You're not an answering machine. You're not Robbie the Robot from Lost in Space. Nothing like that.
Nothing that interesting, I'm afraid.
Okay. Well, why do you think that someone would say something like that?
Well, because one of the things that the enemy always throws at the movement is that it's supposed to be a bunch of geeky losers who can't get girls. And then if that is going to be the official story, you can't admit that there are any women in the movement. And therefore, if you have a woman announcer on Radio Free Northwest, then it must be Harold using a voice modulator, since everyone knows there are no women in this movement.
All right. Well, this is one of the problems that we do have. I know we don't have as many women members as we should do. And so I can almost understand why that question would come up. But in point of fact, we do, just for the record, guys, we do have a lot of women in the movement. Not a lot, but probably more than any other group that I have ever seen. And see, this is an example of sort of babbling that I'm going to edit out. So anyway,
we should get something of us laughing at something together, because otherwise everyone in the movement is going to think you're sitting here talking back and forth to yourself.
I wouldn't put it past them, I tell you. We were talking about doing this earlier, and, you know, Sally does really well with the scripts, but this is the first time she's ad-libbed, this is the first time she's been on a mic, and I told her, you know, well, you know, if you freeze up in front of a live mic, that's understandable. A lot of people do, and she could be like Stan Marsh, you know, going bleh every time in South Park, you know, every time and that didn't go over very well, did it?
No, I don't do stuff like that.
Okay. Anyway, well, you want to tell us a little bit about yourself? And by the way, I know that we can't really release any details that might have to do with your identity, because I think one of the reasons people do this is they're trying to identify the people who support the Northwest Front, either for their own deranged reasons or because whoever's signing their checks won't find out who's with us and so forth. So we can't release anything that actually might lead them to your doorstep. But anything you'd like to tell us about yourself would be fine.
Well, really, I'm just a normal, everyday person with regular life. I don't know how much more I can say about that. But I've just come to realize that the Northwest independence and the creation of our own free nation here is the way to go, and I'm doing what I can to help.
And now here's the real, live, non-voice modulator Axis Sally reading another one of those pieces that just popped up on the internet many years ago, and that I've hung on to and reposted periodically, and which, like Take the Ceausescu Challenge last week, I did not write either. The author of this one is someone using the single name Redbeard, and it's called The Duty of Revenge.
If we as a race are ever again to live in freedom, if we as a race are ever again to live as proud Aryans, true to our culture and warrior heritage, then we must remember with hatred the deeds of our Zionist enemies, the savage, brutal, dishonorable deeds of the past 60 years which destroyed the greatest flowering of Aryan culture the world has ever known and which left millions of our race dead in a war for Zionist control. If we as a race are to have any future chance of glory and greatness, we must remember with hatred the slavery our people now endures at the hands of our Zionist enemies. We must remember with a raw and passionate hatred how these enemies of ours have tamed and domesticated our people and how they have controlled them and do control them through the tyranny of Jewish ideas. We must remember these things with a raw and passionate hatred because our people must be avenged. Such passionate and hate-filled revenge is the only thing that can inspire us with a holy mission to free our people and win back the freedom we have lost. So it is that we must keep alive the stories of Zionist torture and Zionist atrocities against our people, and in particular against the German people and the loyal followers of the greatest son our Aryan race has ever produced, Adolf Hitler. Millions upon millions of fine Aryans butchered, hundreds of thousands of fine Aryan women raped, tens of thousands of valiant combat veterans tortured by cowardly Zionists, thousands and thousands unjustly imprisoned, and hundreds upon hundreds executed for imaginary war crimes. So it is that we must keep alive the truth about how the Zionists conditioned our people with the ignoble, disgusting, and brazen lie of the Holocaust, and how they have introduced tyrannical laws to imprison our people for hate crimes, and for living and acting like a true, noble, fierce, proud Aryan should. So it is that we must keep alive the truth about how these ignoble Zionists lauded it over our governments and encouraged the migration into our countries of millions upon millions of non-Aryans to destroy our nations, our culture, and take away what little freedom we possessed. If we are ever to regain the freedom we have lost, if we are ever to regain the warrior spirit we have lost, the manhood we have lost, then we must put aside our silly and pathetic squabbles among ourselves and forget our own petty egos. Instead, we must become possessed by this raw and passionate hatred for our real enemies. This hatred of our enemies and this desire for revenge must come before anything else, until we have won back our freedom and can live again among our own kind according to our Aryan customs. Anything less than this passionate desire for revenge is cowardly and unmanly and plays right into the hands of the Zionists. Let these ignoble enemies of ours scheme, cheat, lie, and act as they have always acted, in a cowardly way, getting others to do their dirty work or acting like the cowardly bullies they are. Let them moan and cry about how we are hate-mongers and bigots or whatever. For yes, we are hate-mongers, and proud of it. We hate them and all that they stand for. We shall never cease from hating them and must not cease from hating them until we have finally defeated them. We who are true warriors, true Aryans, true men are not afraid to hate, and we must never be afraid to hate. This is the foremost message we must take out among our people, pure, raw hatred of everything our enemies have done and everything they stand for. We must teach our children to hate our enemies, and we must tell our friends about what the Zionists have done and are doing to our people until these friends hate them with a passion to match our own hatred. We must pass on to others of our race this desire of ours for revenge and this passionate desire of ours for the freedom we have lost. It may take decades for our revenge to come about. It may even take a century or more. But it will and must come about if we are true to our manhood and our warrior Aryan nature. We must forget about legality. We must forget about trying to play the Zionists at their own game of manipulation, cheating, and compromise. We need and must have pure revenge, unsullied by anything else. We must have a pure lust for a war with them, a real bloody reckoning when we can get our hands upon them and give them what they deserve. Our future freedom can only be obtained through a heartfelt passion, and we must stir our people up through a passionate hatred. A hatred at what has been done to us over the past 60 years. We must once again get our blood up and not cease from our mission of revenge until we have defeated our enemies. It is this blood-boiling passion which our enemies really fear. For they know that they will only be defeated when our race has been stirred up into a frenzy of passion. This is why they have gone to so much trouble to try and outlaw hatred and tame and domesticate us. This is why they forever try to keep our people entertained and well-fed and contented, and why they try so hard to re-educate our people and make them into docile pacifists who love everybody, and especially the new foreign arrivals next door. Our enemies fear our warrior blood being roused once again. And this is what we must rouse with our cry for freedom and our cry for retribution for our people killed, maimed, tortured, imprisoned, and brainwashed. The blood of the past 60 years is upon the hands of the Zionists as it will be upon them until we have obtained our satisfaction.
Well, I suppose this would be a good time to dedicate our first musical interlude to Gretchen and Axis Sally and all you other white nationalist women out there in the audience, of whom there are a lot more than there used to be, but not as many as there will be. The song is called Hellcat, and this is Final War.
In a pure white breed, it's a badge of honor for all to see. She holds her head high, she's proud to be the product of Aryan blood and belief. She's a woman that's charming and so full of grace, but a hellcat hides behind her sweet face. She laid down her life just like any man to uphold the truth for which she stands. Future, she holds the key to Aryan race and immortality. Her duty is to teach the children what's right, teach them to be proud to be white. Is this for hate or just plain mean? Well, that's because it's forced to be. If you can see through it, she is loving and kind, at least to those of the Aryan mind. She's a woman that's charming and so full of grace, but a hellcat hides behind her sweet face. She laid down her life just like any man to uphold the truth for which she stands. Future, she holds the key to Aryan race and immortality. Her duty is to teach the children what's right, teach them to be proud to be white. Her will is the future, she holds the key to Aryan race and immortality. Her duty is to teach the children what's right, teach them to be proud to be white. So 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 proud to be white.
People sometimes want to know why I don't come across more positively on these shows and offer ideas for wonderful, fascinating things for us white nationalists to do instead of crabbing all the time about people moving to the Northwest and packing moving vans and giving up what they have to be pioneers and all that depressing stuff that involves risk and inconvenience and sacrifice. Why can't mean, gloomy old Harold come up with something that's fun? Something that'll catch and captivate the 15-minute American attention span? Okay, fine. Let's talk about a potentially very worthwhile project, which white nationalists could do very easily, because hundreds of small groups of people do it every year. First, a little digression here. I don't have much of a social life outside work. Well, none, actually. And other than reading, my main source of socialization is watching the cheapest movies on DVD I can find, either from Blockbuster or the 99-cent rentals you get at grocery stores, or sometimes the cheap used DVDs you find in bins and various places, Goodwill stores, so forth and so on. Anyway, the upshot of all this is that over the past 20 years, I've seen a lot of films, many of them B-movies and some of them C-movies, because that's what you find in the cheap bins and racks. Now, one of the things it's very easy to pick up in places like that is these B or C horror or slasher flicks with actors nobody ever heard of and usually with lousy plots, lousy writing, and atrocious acting, including a couple of exhibitionist blonde bimbos who want to take off their clothes and jiggle their bouncing boobies and engage in pointless sex scenes that have nothing to do with the plot. Now, apparently, that's a standard part of the formula, and your film won't get picked up for distribution by the usual networks that stock Blockbuster and Hollywood Video and Albertsons and so on, unless you have a few bouncing boobies. I'm reminded of the old Joe Bob Briggs movie reviews. Joe Bob rated movies on the three B's, Beast, Breasts, and Blood. Now, you may or may not have seen some of these flicks, but basically many of them are made by actual student actors and directors, and the movie itself is some college or university's film and media class graduation project, with help from the drama department and a very low budget. They'll usually be a slasher flick or a monster or zombie flick, something like that, because that way there's no need for historical costumes or specially built sets. Nobody needs to know how to ride a horse like they would if you were making a Western. The characters can wear their ordinary street clothes, and you can film in somebody's house or basement or barn, or the monster or slasher can go chasing people through the woods on somebody's property. Or maybe you can get permission from the city to film in some warehouse with, you know, steam coming out of the pipes, something like that. Slasher and horror films also let your special effects and makeup people go wild with all kinds of fake blood and gore and guts flying all over the place, especially if you're doing a zombie flick. And you can make up everybody in the senior class at your little cow college as zombies and have them staggering around moaning brains and gnawing on blood-covered prop arms and legs and whatnot. Bear with me, there is a point to all this. I'm sure some of you must have seen some of these films, and every now and then one of them will get a hit. More by accident than anything else. The classic example of this is that flick The Evil Dead, which was how Sam Raimi and Bruce Campbell got their start. The original was filmed in 1981 at some old shack up in the Smoky Mountains, and it cost a few $1,000s to make, and it raked in millions. Another more recent example is the Blair Witch Project. That was nothing but three kids walking around out in the woods with video cameras. I read somewhere that it cost about $30,000 to make and distribute, and once again, it made millions of dollars. Now, I think that you guys can see the point. I think you can see what I'm getting at here. Why, you may ask, don't we form a white nationalist movie company and start making our own movies with our own actors, if only shorts for upload to YouTube? Wow, I bet nobody ever thought of that before, Harold. Well, as a matter of fact, yes, somebody did think of that before. I did. And to be fair, so have several other people down through the past years since the invention of the video cam. Not once, to my knowledge, has this idea ever reached anywhere near the implementation stage from anybody in the white nationalist world. Why? One word, and I'll give you a hint, that word begins with a C. Now, I'm not talking about YouTubes. They're a different kettle of fish. We do indeed have some very talented video makers who patch together images and music for YouTube video presentations. We have a lot of guys like that, in fact. And some of them are really good, and they make some brilliant videos, which of course are chased all over YouTube by the Jews who run it, trying to pull their horrible racist work offline. But YouTube is something that you can do alone. Sitting all by yourself, hunched over your computer in the darkness of your rec room or your bedroom, which is where our people like to hide like grubs and worms under a rock. YouTube requires no personal contact, no physical interaction in the real world between real human beings, no long-distance driving, no sacrifice of playtime. YouTube allows our people to interact only with a machine that won't talk back and won't make demands of us and will usually more or less do what it's told without having to argue or reason or persuade or compromise with it. And that's what us white nationalists love most of all. We love being able to feel that we've done our racial duty and accomplished something without ever having to deal with people. And that includes our own people. Especially our own people. The personal computer gives us that feeling of power and control and accomplishment. To white nationalists, the computer is like a heroin buzz. It's nutritionally empty, addictive, and toxic, but it feels great. Making an actual independent movie, a film, a feature presentation of an hour or more, would require a team effort by a large number of white nationalists coming together physically in one place, meaning airline tickets and a lot of long-distance driving on weekends and vacation days. People with skills and people with money and people with equipment all willing to give up some of their leisure time that normally would be allotted for play and drive long distances to meet other white people and carry out a specific project for the benefit of their race and not themselves. This is the kind of people that white nationalism lacks. Depending on the movie and the script, there would have to be at least half a dozen people involved, but more likely a dozen at least. Actors, a director, camera people, sound guys, grips for loading and unloading trucks and building sets, makeup artists, special effects guys, stage and property managers to set up the sets and scenes and keep track of the props and the physical equipment on the shoot, blah, blah, blah. You know, next time you see some crappy little B-movie, watch the credits roll and count how many individual people it takes to make even one stupid little no-talent flick that went straight to DVD. A white nationalist indie film company would have to have all those people, or most of them anyway. And they couldn't phone it in from behind a computer keyboard. They would have to take time off from their shitty little day jobs working at the warehouse or the Rite Aid. They would have to get into their cars and drive hundreds and maybe thousands of miles for the shoot, and they would have to devote days and weeks and maybe months of personal leisure time that they would normally use for play to a white racial effort to something that will bring them little, if any, money or tangible benefit. And that's why this will never happen. An independent white nationalist movie company is like the Northwest Migration. Everyone is sitting around waiting for someone else to go first. Now, like I mentioned before, I actually floated this very idea about 7 years ago, if memory serves. Now, this was back before Facebook, and so I did what net Nazis did in those days. I started a Yahoo group. I can't remember exactly what it was called. Aryan Film, I think, something like that. Anyway, for about 6 months, this Yahoo group went great guns. We ended up with about 100 members, and there were at least 4 or 5 posts every day with all kinds of valuable suggestions, script ideas, comments on technical stuff like what kind of video cams and sound mixing boards and other equipment we'd need, people volunteering to act, people volunteering to direct, a few people even offering to raise money, so forth and so on. Now, I offered my own services as a script writer to write the screenplays for any productions that this company would come up with. Now, for a brief time, everybody was on fire with enthusiasm, as we so often are, and then the inevitable happened. The point in time arrived where we had to turn off the computer, arise from behind the keyboard, take time off from our crappy day jobs, go get in our car, and use what would otherwise be playtime to drive long distances and physically meet with other white nationalists, to interact with people and not machines, and to do something good for the race and not for our own benefit. Guess what happened then? Posts to the Aryan Film Group just withered away. People who had promised money and equipment and skills stopped posting and stopped answering their emails. All of a sudden, it had threatened to get real, and they ran away, like so-called white nationalists do every time. The Aryan Film Group is dead now. I just checked my Yahoo account because I couldn't recall whether I deleted it or not, but I must have, or else Yahoo did. Anyway, it's not there anymore. If there's anyone out there, by the way, who would like to explore this idea of a Northwest independent film company seriously, then send me a private email. I'm not able at the moment to embark full-time on a project of that magnitude, but I'm certainly willing to listen to what anyone has to say and give what support I can. There is no reason on the face of this earth why a group of people, even with the limited manpower and resources that we have, could not do this, create an independent film company and begin producing our own films and working up a distribution network for them. People like Alex Jones and a dozen other right-wing guru nut types have done this already for their own homemade DVDs on conspiracy theories and the Federal Reserve and 9/11 and whatnot. Like everything else, it's not a question of we can't do it. We just won't do it because we can't be bothered. And that's fucking disgraceful. Quick email from Steve in California. Dear Harold, why don't you talk about the Holocaust myth more? Well, Steve, actually, I have talked about the Holocaust several times on Radio Free Northwest before, but that was many podcasts back, and frankly, I can't recall which episodes. I'm running a bit behind now, so I'll let the late Dr. William L. Pierce do a Holocaust commentary for me.
Hello. Imagine that a robber walks into a bank, points a pistol at a teller, hands her a bag, and demands that she put all the money from her cash drawer in it. At first, she protests, but then after he threatens to shoot, she fills the robber's bag with cash. And then imagine that as the robber walks out of the bank with his bag of loot, the bank guard opens the door for him, smiles at him, offers to hail a cab for him, and tells him to come again soon. After that, it's not difficult to imagine that he probably will come again soon. That's about the way it's been with the Jews recently. 2 years ago, they put a gun to the head of the Swiss people collectively and demanded billions of dollars in reparations for Swiss bank accounts they claimed had been owned by Jews who disappeared during the Second World War. The Swiss initially protested that unclaimed Jewish bank accounts from the 1930s and 1940s amounted at most to a few million dollars, not to billions. And besides, the war ended more than 50 years ago, and claims should have been filed long ago. The Jews threatened to shoot, figuratively speaking, by having their bought politicians in the United States prevent Swiss banks from doing business in America. Eventually, they walked away with $1.25 billion in loot, with the Swiss apologizing for not having coughed it up sooner. After that sort of success with the Swiss, one could hardly expect the Jews to give up extortion and go straight. So anyway, they were back again soon, with demands against the Volkswagen company for having used Jewish workers during the Second World War and providing them only with room and board, but not paying them union-scale wages. One might think that these Jewish workers would be grateful to Volkswagen for keeping them alive during the war, feeding them and giving them a roof over their heads when so many German civilians had only bombed-out ruins to live in. Well, if you thought that, you just don't understand Jews. The Jews told the Volkswagen company that if it ever wanted to sell any more cars in America, it had better cough up soon. And the bought politicians and the media bosses in America began rattling their sabers and talking loudly about sanctions of various sorts against Volkswagen. And so, like the Swiss banks, Volkswagen coughed up the money. Then the feeding frenzy started, just as I told you it would 2 years ago, when I predicted that after the Jews had cleaned out the Swiss, they would go after other victims in a long list. Volkswagen wasn't the only company which had used involuntary labor during the war. The Jews went after Daimler-Benz and BMW and Siemens. And Switzerland wasn't the only country where Jews could claim that Uncle Abe had stashed some of his loot 60 years ago before the war. So they sued banks in France and in Britain and began moaning and whining in the media that the banks were being insensitive to poor, deserving Holocaust survivors who suddenly had remembered Uncle Abe's millions and needed it now. And then they remembered the insurance companies in Italy and Switzerland and Britain and elsewhere from whom they could claim that Uncle Abe once had had a life insurance policy. Then they remembered that the Swedes owed them gold, and the Danes, and the Norwegians, even the Poles, whom the Jews had ruled as Bolshevik commissars for nearly 50 years after the war, owed them, they claimed. The racket has worked the same in every case. Pay us, or we will have our bought Gentile politicians pass laws making it impossible for you to continue doing business, and our people in the media will paint you as monsters who want to hang on to the profit you made when poor Uncle Abe and Aunt Sarah were crammed into gas chambers, and then the gullible Gentile lemmings won't buy your products. If you give us any trouble or resist our demands, we'll make an example of you the way we did with the Swiss banks. Just pay us the few $100 million we're demanding now, and we'll leave you alone. Otherwise, it'll end up costing you a lot more. And it has worked every time. Not one banker or businessman has stood up to them and flatly refused to pay. Not one president or prime minister has said to them, "All right, Jew boys, you try a boycott against my country, and we'll organize a boycott against Israel. We'll round up all the Jews in our country and send them packing." Not one has called the Jews bluff. They've all calculated that it is cheaper to pay the gangsters than to fight them, and so they pay. Honor means nothing to these businessmen and politicians. Principles mean nothing to them. All they care about is continuing to make money, continuing to stay in office. With this sort of attitude predominant among the Gentiles, one can hardly blame the Jews for turning to extortion on a larger scale than ever before. They are successful at it, therefore they continue to do it. And they don't limit themselves to Europe or to those who allegedly cooperated with the Germans in their demand for reparations. A few months ago, they filed a claim against Britain for $600 million. They claimed the British government confiscated from Jews between 1940 and 1942 when the British governed Palestine. Remember, the Jews were waging a guerrilla war against the British prior to 1948, when the British finally gave up and pulled out, letting the Jews slaughter the Palestinians and establish the Jewish state of Israel on Palestinian land. The Jews were kidnapping and murdering British soldiers in Palestine and assassinating diplomats. In 1946, the Jews used a terrorist bomb to blow up the King David Hotel in Jerusalem, which was the British government headquarters. This Jewish forerunner of the Oklahoma City bombing killed a large number of British civilians and military people. And now the Jews are demanding $600 million in reparations from the British. And of course, the Jews also are expecting payoffs from American companies. Both Ford and General Motors had subsidiaries working in Germany when the Second World War began. The Ford plant in Germany made military vehicles for the Germans throughout the war, and the General Motors subsidiary, Opel, did the same. And so now the Jews are claiming that both Ford and General Motors owe them a great deal of money because of that. The Jews already have filed a class action suit against Ford in a federal court in New Jersey, seeking hundreds of millions of dollars in wages plus interest for Jews who worked in Ford's German plant during the war. And because the businessmen who run Ford and General Motors today are the same sort as those who run the Volkswagen company, they undoubtedly will pay off the Jews rather than risk having the media portray them as insensitive types who profited from the so-called Holocaust and now refuse to share their loot with the poor, deserving Jewish survivors. 200 years ago, the American motto was millions for defense, but not 1 cent for tribute.
Okay, second music break. Another rock number here. Now, this is not a skinhead or a white noise band. It's actually just your average run-of-the-mill skeezy rock and roller types. It's a group from the 1980s called the Blasters. But if you listen to the words, you'll see that this is a song about a race-mixing nigger who goes after a white girl and gets what's coming to him. So I'd say this is definitely RFN music break material. This is called Dark Night.
Hangs like a dead man from a white oak tree. People sitting on porches thinking how things used to be. Dark night. It's a dark night. Dark night. It's a dark night. Neighborhood was changing, strangers moving in. A new boy fell for a local girl, but she made eyes at him. She was young and pretty, no stranger to other men.
but windows were being locked at night, and whole lines drawn again. I thought these things didn't matter anymore. I thought all that blood had been shed long ago. Dark night. It's a dark night. To the outskirts, he pledged his love to her. They thought it was their secret, but someone knew where they were. He held her so close, he asked about her dreams. When a bullet from a passing car made the young girl scream. I thought these things didn't happen anymore. I thought all that blood had been shed long ago. Dark night. It's a dark night. Dark night. It's a dark night.
The time has come now for me to say some things to all of you, and to say them clearly, to spell it all out for you in such a way that you cannot possibly fail to understand what I'm telling you. I have always avoided pure clarity on some of these topics for fear of offending and alienating not your normal run-of-the-mill dysfunctional white people of the kind that clutter up every nationalist list, but because these things cut too close to the bone for even the better sort among us. I've frankly been afraid of alienating people whom we really do need, and hamstringing even what little I am able to accomplish because the people who make it possible are off in a corner somewhere sulking because Harold said something on the internet. But I have now come to believe that my failure to speak out in the strongest possible terms on some of these matters may have been an error on my part, and a disservice to the 14 words. If we are to have any hope of success, then our movement must be based on the purest of truth, self-knowledge, and iron character. And the ultimate success of this cause of Northwest independence and a homeland for our folk is more important than any short-term setbacks which may result from when some individuals get their noses out of joint because they don't like something I said on the internet. Yesterday, we had one of those incredibly silly teapot tempests that can arise on the net without a moment's warning, like a white squall on the Great Lakes. That was the straw that broke the camel's back, but this isn't about that. What I have to say is not about some nonsense on Facebook. It's about the past 39 years. Well, that's how long it's been since I joined the old Franklin Road National Socialist White People's Party. And that is how long I have been battling against the enemy within. The only enemy who will ever truly defeat us and destroy our race. The enemy we see in the mirror every morning. In the past several weeks, we have had several incidents occur here in the northwest section of the white nationalist movement, some of it peripherally associated with the NF and some of it not. But I will not go into details or name any names because I don't want to perpetuate these events or the names of the people involved. As the liberals would say, I don't want them entering our narrative any more than is unavoidably necessary. I will say this with quiet pride. Although we don't have such a thing as formal membership in the NF, these incidents do not involve in any culpable or direct way any of our people who are what one might call primary associates of the NF. We have always exercised great care in who we allow to get sufficiently close to us to get seriously involved. For example, we seem to be the only tendency in what's left of the movement who actually do basic background checks when someone wants to meet with us. That policy is paying off, and hopefully it will continue to do so. But we're not the only people who are active in the Northwest, and some of these other circles aren't quite as focused and as careful as we are about who they allow to become involved in their activities. Again, I'm not going to get specific here. But instead, I'm going to speak about some larger issues, and if the shoe fits, some of us will know who needs to be wearing it. First off, let's talk about informing. In every introductory packet of Northwest Front literature that we send out to inquirers, we include a leaflet entitled The Red Lines, Acceptable Limits of White Nationalist Behavior. It lists 7 points, which I refer to as the protocols of white nationalist behavior. I won't read the whole thing, but I would like to direct your attention to protocols number 3 and 5. Protocol number 3 reads, any form of collaboration with Zog in order to do harm to any other white nationalist is absolutely forbidden. Protocol number 5 reads, no one in the racially conscious community shall deliberately reveal, disclose, or in any way transmit personal information about any other racially conscious person with the intent to do harm. Before we go any further, by way of full disclosure, I need to tell you something about myself. I have a deep and visceral loathing for an informer, a tattletale, a man or a woman so weak and cowardly that they cannot fight their own battles but have to go running to authority looking for the teacher's skirts or an attorney's briefcase or hired guns to hide behind. This goes back to my own childhood when I was a Bart Simpson kind of kid, and I would get up to all kinds of anarchist behavior in school. And, of course, my bane in life was always the tattletale. Some little snitch, usually girls, but sometimes creepy little boys as well, who would go running off and tell the teacher about my latest hijinks. Now, this seems to have stuck with me. I have always despised a rat. One of the finest personal compliments I have ever received was from an Italian comrade. We were talking for a while on the general subject of informers, and I made my views on the subject pretty clear. And he said to me after a while, you know, Harold, you may be a southern redneck and all, but when it comes to any cooperation with the police or the government, you're a real Sicilian at heart. I also want to make something clear, which perhaps we forget. There are different kinds of informing, and not all of them involve selling out your friends to the police or FBI for money, or to get off some legal hook they've got you on. We have to approach this from the viewpoint that all authority in this society is irredeemably corrupt and evil, which is pretty much the case. And by that I mean anyone in any kind of authority, be it an FBI agent or a district attorney or your idiot boss at work or the multinational company you work for or the media or the American Medical Association or the city zoning board on up to Obongo himself. They are all part and parcel of the power structure that's trying to kill us all and destroy a 3,000-year-old civilization and the race that created it. How can you tell when someone is part and parcel of the system and therefore to be avoided like the plague by way of assisting them in any capacity? Simple. Number one, they're rich. It is now almost impossible to accumulate wealth in this society through genuine hard work or without compromising every principle of human decency and committing horrible, vile acts along the way. And I'm not just talking about individual people. I'm talking about banks and corporations and churches and anybody with a lot of money. In the world the Jews have created, money is power. And if anyone or any institution is allowed to obtain and keep the power that is money, then it's a far better than even bet that they've done wrong in order to do so. Secondly, they are able to exercise some kind of actual petty power over the lives of ordinary people. Bertolt Brecht once made the famous remark about the banality of evil. Anyone who has obtained petty power over ordinary people, over their lives, over their money, over their homes, over their children, be it a supervisor or a bank or a school board, whatever, probably shouldn't be exercising that power, because in order to obtain it, they have made at least a tacit agreement with this entire evil system to act as their enforcer. So you see that informing can include any kind of use or appeal to anyone in a position of power, be it lethal or petty, to use that power against a fellow racially conscious white. To do so is a violation of principle number 3, and as far as I'm concerned, cuts that person off from the white racial community. No matter how petty a matter it may seem, assisting anyone in authority in doing any kind of harm to a fellow white man or woman is collaboration with the enemy, because the entire power structure, both public and private, is the enemy, not just the FBI or the Justice Department. Collaboration is like being a little bit pregnant. You either are a collaborator or you aren't, in my own little purist world anyway. Secondly, collaboration and informing doesn't always have to be out of greed or fear or even out of malice. Sometimes it's possible to collaborate out of simple stupidity, out of arrogance in thinking that you're more clever than the cops or the FBI and you can play them. No, you can't. That is never how it works. Any small bit of information you give them about anyone or anything is an act of collaboration, and it doesn't matter why you did it. I don't care what this other racially conscious white person did to you that you happen not to like, or has gotten your nose out of joint or offended your ego. You just don't do it. Period. End of story. Now, let's talk about ego. I've had it with ego in the movement. I have had it up to here with people who have skins as thin as tissue paper and who view even the mildest disagreement or criticism as an undying and unforgivable insult and an excuse for years of slander and vilification and petty-minded viciousness. Now, some of you know who I'm talking about, and no, I don't mean this latest crop of internet goat dancers, and I'm not just talking about those who spent years harassing and annoying me with petty garbage and malicious lawsuits and petty vandalism and leaving their turds on my doorstep for me to step in. This is not just about me. I'm talking about an entire movement phenomenon here, and one that anyone who's been in this for a length of time will be very familiar with. I'm referring to 39 years of observing this kind of wretched, stupid, and destructive behavior on the part of people who claim to believe as we do, and who claim to be working for the 14 words. Now, some of these people who are guilty of this are probably listening to me right now, and I really would like to grab you and shake you until your teeth rattle and bellow in your ear, "What the fuck is wrong with you? What is going on in whatever you've got between your ears that passes for a mind? You claim to be a white nationalist, and you claim to believe in the 14 words, and yet you waste what precious little we have left in time and resources by wrestling with your own personal demons in public and turning every attempt we have ever made to resist into a joke. Now listen to me and hear what I say. You are a part of this struggle, but you and whatever your little personal or emotional hobby horse happens to be are not the be-all and end-all of this struggle. And the world won't end if someone says something unkind about you on a blog or a website. Believe me, I of all people can tell you this. This struggle is not about you. It is not about me. It is about making sure that 100 years from now, this continent is not inhabited solely by shit-skinned savages. I don't care if somebody 10 years ago said something you don't like on the internet. When that happens, you don't collapse into hysterics and spend the rest of your life trying to do down that person. Get over it and drive on. I have to every day. This is Saga.
Eyes shining bright with unspilled tears, thinking about all those wasted years, when everything worth living for is gone. And brother, I find it hard to keep fighting on. Falling down
I can't bear to witness.
If this is the way
Now let's talk about the raving loony bin, which is the white internet. And yes, I'm aware of the irony of my using the internet to talk about what's wrong with it. 500 years ago, the Spanish explorer Ponce de Leon arrived in Florida in search of the Fountain of Youth. He never found it. But we today in America have discovered a fountain of childishness. It's called the internet. On the surface, there's nothing bad or mystifying about the internet. It's simply a lot of communications devices and databases all hooked together. But what is horrifying is what the internet reveals about the mental and moral state that white Americans have fallen into. To be blunt, it seems like we're all a little nuts. That may be understandable, but that doesn't mean that we don't have to do something about it. To me, one of the most horrifying things about the whole issue of space madness on the internet is the fact that if you look at some of these posts, they read like they were written by a rather nasty child. And yet, these are the work of men and a few women who are in their 40s and 50s, my age, for Christ's sake. It used to be that age brought with it a certain wisdom and dignity and gravitas in someone's behavior. But now, on the internet, both we and our enemies are treated to the spectacle of middle-aged people acting like a bunch of 13-year-olds who missed their daily dose of Ritalin. I'm tempted to make some broad and resounding generalization here, like the movement has to reevaluate its relationship with the internet, but the net itself isn't the problem. And in any case, we have to use it. You may be surprised to learn that, well, more recently than you might think, I personally kicked around the idea of just taking the whole Northwest thing off the internet and simply using my computer as a word processor and a printing device for the Northwest Observer. But you can't do that. The internet is like atomic power and gunpowder. It's here, and it can't be uninvented, and we have to use it. Like I said, it's nothing but a bunch of machines connected together. The problem is us, white people in general, and white nationalists in particular, and what the lure of consequences-free misbehavior turns us into. All white Americans are under severe stress because we live in an unnatural world that denies us the opportunity to live up to our full potential. And racially aware whites are under more stress than most, because we know it's unnatural. But it's time we learned to use this technology as a weapon against the racial enemy and not as a hallucinogenic drug. The enemy is sure as hell using it against us. I get laughed at and sneered at on the web when I refer to things such as Cass Sunstein's cognitive dissonance operation run out of the White House with the purpose of disrupting and creating demoralization among dissident websites, and things like persona management software, which is now probably already in operation, allowing one individual to maintain up to 16 separate IDs on social networking and other internet sites, each with a different and false IP address in order to avoid detection, with the avowed purpose of manipulating public opinion and the comment sections of blogs and news sites. but these things exist. I'm not making them up. You can do a little Googling and find out for yourself that these programs are very real. And with a little careful examination, I think you'll find it hard to disagree that it's at least possible that a lot of this anti-Northwest crap you see on various racial websites and V-bulletin boards comes not from actual white people who disagree with us, but from such black ops sources. This is one reason that all of us need to clean up our act on the Internet, so that we can differentiate between genuine white racial nationalists and Sunstein's trolls. Somehow, we are going to have to establish a generally recognized and practiced protocol within the white racial resistance movement to use this technology seriously and responsibly, not comport ourselves online like a bunch of horses' asses, so that when someone comes along on a website or a blog and still acts like a horse's ass, we can pretty much assume that he's one of Sunstein's people, or one of those Israeli trolls we read about, or working for the ADL or SPLC, whoever. I personally believe that a good start here would be a new attitude towards the whole idea of anonymity on the Internet. I'm perfectly well aware that most people have jobs and families and lives to protect, and that for them using a pseudonym or an anonymizer can sometimes be a matter of life and death. I get that. But when someone begins to shout the odds to the rest of us, as we used to say in Rhodesia, when someone presumes to take the first step in a potential leadership role either by advancing a new idea or else by offering balanced and legitimate criticism or else deranged personal attacks and slanders against existing ideas and leaders and events, then we have a right to know who is talking to us. Who is this person? What is his track record? Who does he hang with on the Internet and in person? Who is or was his racial guru, if any? Has anyone ever met this person in the flesh and sized up the cut of his jib? Is he even white, or is he really the holy Rabbi Hyman Hebelbaum from Temple Schmuckel, who's running a game on us, either with Cass Sunstein cutting him a check or just for his own venomous purposes? If someone presumes to tell us all about how the Northwest Imperative, or anyone else, is all wrong, no, 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 you mustn't do that, you mustn't do anything at all except continue to sit behind your keyboard and tap, 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 tap until our hair turns white and we all die of old age, but he still won't let you know who he really is or get a look at him, that's a red flag. If someone constantly trashes anybody who tries to do anything at all, but refuses to offer an alternative plan of his own besides the continuance of the status quo, then that's a red flag. If some Internet Looney Tune persistently shows up on blogs, V-bulletin boards, so forth and so on, and he does nothing but run his mouth, disrupt, plant rumors, and sow confusion, but no one knows who he is and no one has ever met him, then that's a red flag. If the owner of the group refuses to do anything about this behavior, and even gives the troll moderator rights and refuses to listen to any complaints, if he won't reveal who the troll is or even if he's physically met the man, and if he bans those who complain about the lunatic behavior, then frankly, to my mind, that's a red flag too, and you need to start looking at the group owner a lot more closely. You see, we can, in fact, do a lot to isolate and minimize the damage done by cognitive dissonance operatives on the Internet, but only if we can tell who they are by their behavior. If all of us are doing nothing but calling each other names, trying to show how clever we are at somebody else's expense, hollering and screaming like lunatics in a rubber room, then we have no way to tell. We, the legitimate white nationalists of all tendencies, have to make an open and acknowledged pact among ourselves to stop acting like loons, and to use this as a medium of propaganda and persuasion for our cause itself, and not as therapy for whatever weird things are going on in our own minds and our own lives. These machines are tools. These machines are potential weapons against the tyranny that is destroying us. They are not therapy for dysfunctional whites who come home after a bad day at work, down a six-pack, and then go online to work out their frustrations and wrestle with their own personal demons in public. I know, it's hard sometimes not to cry, ho ho hee hee ha ha, and let slip the dogs of lunacy. I'm not immune to the lure of Mr. Hyde on the keyboard, and I slip myself sometimes. I shouldn't do it, and neither should you. we need to make an informal but definite agreement among ourselves that we are going to stop all this nonsense whenever we get online, and we are going to start using these machines against the racial enemy instead of against ourselves like some kind of Monty Python suicide squad. Because right now, this internet thing is the only really potentially powerful weapon we've got. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.